Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. In times of yore, their presence was seen and felt everywhere in the natural world. They spun the moon, made flowers grow, and springs gush forth. They were the natural allies of both animals and humanity. They had the magical powers that created whole peoples and brought forth light. But they were often undermined, under attack, and coveted by powerful figures and forces. And yet, they rose strong and powerful even when it required great sacrifice. These were the Celtic goddesses and heroines whose stories have been kept alive for hundreds, if not thousands of years, and who have inspired women throughout the ages to seek and take sustenance from the divine feminine, to nurture themselves and their feminine essence in the light cast by these figures, and to honor the balance of nature. Now, Ain Kate Sullivan has brought them to life for this generation, capturing their stories on the pages of two remarkable award-winning and highly acclaimed books, Heroines of Avalon and Other Tales and Legends of the Grail, Stories of Celtic Goddesses. With a master's and doctorate in literature from Columbia University and King's College in London, Dr. Sullivan actually walked the British Isles and Ireland to reclaim the stories that she has assembled in her Legends of the Grail series, the Grail being defined as the divine feminine. We welcome to Common Threads the author of Heroines of Avalon and Other Tales and Legends of the Grail, Dr. Ain Kate Sullivan. Hello, Ain.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Certainly. And congratulations. I neglected to mention that your book, Heroines of Avalon and Other Tales, has just won the 2019 Independent Publishers Book Award Gold in Visionary New Age Fiction and the 2019 Silver with Nautilus in Women's Fiction. So that's outstanding.
I am thrilled, absolutely thrilled.
So let me ask you a few questions. Let's concentrate on Avalon, if we could. You say in the introduction, and I'm paraphrasing here. I don't have the book right in front of me right now. But you say that when you discover where the clay of your body is from, it's easier or it's possible to become more acquainted with the soul. I find that statement something that has wisdom in it, but needs to be parsed out a bit. Tell us what that means to you.
I will, and I'll tell you a little story along with that. So, because it takes a while to find Avalon, I feel. So I live in Virginia, and our family has a farm. And the story is that it was given as a land grant to our family in 1668. And so there are gravestones there of the men that came over from Northumbria. They were the Knights of Northumbria. So I had to, at a certain point in my life, go to Bamburgh Castle and track these characters down. So if you can imagine, I'm sitting with my grandmother, who was actually a Sunday school teacher. She was very lovely, very Christian. She would stir her pot, whatever she was preparing, she would stir it, and she would tell me stories. And as the steam rose, I just absolutely followed her tales to these other worlds, you know. So I was lucky enough to get an overseas research award to King's College London, and went, and I didn't know what it was for. It was kind of funny. I got a full ride if I did the work of Lady Gregory. She was a folklorist and a playwright and the patron of W.B. Yeats, and they were very interested in having somebody do her plays, you know. So I said yes without really even knowing who she was, and first charged off up to Northern England to find my people. And what I loved about it was that with my feet on the soil in that place, I could dream with the land and imagine what it was like to live in that time period. And so I started questing in that way, and that's really how the stories came about. They're fairly organic, but I started going to these sacred sites, and of course to Ireland, to collect folklore in the way that Lady Gregory would have. One of her collections was Cuchulainn of Mehevna, who was this great Irish hero, and in that I found a lot of Celtic goddesses that were incredible. I had never run across these characters who, you know, in a lot of traditions, women get lost, or they're not important, or their furniture, and here I find this tradition, this Celtic tradition, where the women were battling in the fields with their men. They were druidesses, and they were healers, and they were warrior women, and they were judges. They served all through the entire culture, and so I became quite fascinated by them.
So let's go back to that statement. That's wonderful background, but parse this out just a little bit more. When you discover the clay your body is from, it's easy to become more acquainted with the soul. Are you saying that? Are you encouraging people to take a similar trek to find out physically where people are from? I know that I talk to different people and I get different responses all the time. Some people are so fascinated about their past, and when they talk about going to the land of their ancestors, whether it's in Europe or Asia, wherever in the world, they speak of it as pilgrimage. Other people speak of it as going simply as tourists. So I gather you are someone for whom this was not tourism. This was pilgrimage.
Well, initially it was an academic folklore collection, and it shifted. It actually shifted back to the Avalon question. It shifted at some point, and it was actually when I was in Somerset in England. And I went to a very holy place called the Chalice Well. And at the time, I was just entering deep meditation. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this place, but it's a place that was came to Tudor Pole in a vision during World War II. He knew he had to protect this place. And in Celtic folklore and in the Celtic church, it said that Joseph of Arimathea brought the cup that had the blood of Christ to this place, and that's how the Chalice Well got its name. And other people say, no, it wasn't the cup of Christ, it was Mary Magdalene, and then other people say it was actually his daughter Sarah. So who knows? There's a lot of folklore in the place. What I will say about it, it is potent. It's a potent place. It's a thin place. And so I started to have an experience, and this is when it will shift from folklore to, oh, I'm feeling a presence. I'm beginning to feel a presence. And so now we're shifting into pilgrimage, or I call it questing. And for me, it became a heroine's quest. So I started to have a sense of what it was like to feel the presence of the divine feminine. And I started to connect that to the stories of the Grail, the chalice in the Christian sense, and then as you take the stories back, when we go into Celtic folklore, you can go back 10,000 years to the stories of the Caillach, the old woman of the world, where it becomes a Grail and then a cauldron and a cooking pot. So Avalon... They say there's an entrance to Avalon. Let me tell you what Avalon is. So you have to understand when you're working with folklore, the bards knew the reason people would tell stories is that they knew if you tell people what to think or how to behave, they probably won't do it. But if you tell stories, people can go along with you and they can understand why certain events take place, why certain things happen. And so to enter Avalon, you go to some place like the Chalice Well, which is, in the old days, it was called the Isle of Glass, and so you could go into meditation there, and if you shifted the way, so you're no longer working with your five senses. You're starting to work with your imagination. You start to open up quite often through an apple tree. You walk through an apple tree, and you start to enter the enchanted land. So now we're consciously dreaming. And at that point, if you were lucky, it might be that the priestesses of Avalon would come forward towards you. And you might smell roses, or you might get just feel an incredible amount of love, or you might have a vision, you might have an apparition. And some people actually would then travel on a boat to Avalon. And the Irish sense, it's Tírnanog or Tírnaban, the land under the wave or the land of women. In Somerset, it would be Avalon that you would go to. So it's the Isle of Apples. It's the enchanted Isle of Apples. And the story of journeying for the golden apple appears in many, many different traditions. But in that particular location, it is Avalon, the place where it's eternal spring, everyone's healthy, the weather's always beautiful, there's always healing to be found there.
Speaking of folklore versus reality, if I read this correctly, you were saying that there is a story that your grandfather is buried on the family farm, but you can't guarantee that. Did I read that correctly?
Well, these were the grandfathers. I'm still doing a lot of research about it. I know I found the Forrester Family Bible, and in the Forrester Family Bible, our lineage goes back to the Forresters of Northumbria, and to the Blantons, and also to the Amos. They all seem to have come from a very similar area. We have a vase that was a gift from the King of England. It doesn't say who. I'm assuming Charles II. It might have been Charles I. It was given to the family, to the Amos family, because they were the farriers for the king. And so we have these little glimpses, and then I have, through Ancestry.com, have followed our family pedigree, and then have DNA matches. So I've been able to do the research that way and piece it together, and you never know. The family Bible takes us back to Adam and Eve. Is that true? I don't know, but it's very interesting because you can follow the from the Knights of Northumbria, you go up into the Kings of Scotland, so we were in that particular lineage, the last of the Gaelic kings, so that would have been through Robert the Bruce. And then they go back down through Ireland to Niall of the Nine Hostages, who was pretty ferocious, and his wife, Mungfind.
So wait, you're saying that this person who's buried on the family farm, or not, is not two generations away from you. You're talking about
These people that were buried there, they're definitely buried there. There's no doubt about that. But they would have come over on a ship called the Safety in 1668. So they're, gosh, what is that, six generations,
mm-hmm.
I think? Might be a bit more. So obviously, actually, it's interesting. The family farm is still intact. The legacy, we call it the Legacy Farm. And there are pictures as far back as you can take photography they were tobacco farmers, mostly, that I could track. And then the land grant, in the 1600s, there were a lot of land grants given, and they would have been, they could have been, because they were had done some service to the king and it was a gift. More often than not, they would sail the boats. They would be the people who would actually be the sailors, and they would get passengers safely to the United States, and then they would work for 3 years, and then each family member would be granted 50 acres. And if you think at the time, it was a lot of land here. So that's probably how it happened. And it is, anyway, it's still there. I can walk on it. It's 200 acres, and the photography is there. But there are a lot of pieces. It's like having a puzzle, and then there are a few pieces that are missing. So some of them you have to imagine and place.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Ane Cates Sullivan. She is the author of Heroines of Avalon and Other Tales. Let's talk a little bit more about Lady Gregory and the scholastic, the academic pecking order of mythology. Apparently, in the ivory towers a few generations ago, if it wasn't Greco-Roman mythology, it didn't have the cachet. Irish mythology wasn't in the same category as Greco-Roman. And what part did Lady Gregory play in parsing this out?
That's a really brilliant question, because she really changed that around. So Lady Gregory was nobility, and Anglo-Irish nobility, and became very interested in the stories that she was hearing. Now, until I think it was really the Easter Uprising, 1917, if people told these Gaelic stories or performed any of their practices with the old gods and goddesses, you could be killed for it. They weren't respected, and Irish was banned. You know, at one point there was a genocide on Irish people. So Lady Gregory was a nationalist, and she really believed in Ireland. There's some people that say that there's a root race. There's a root race that comes out of Ireland. And so she learned Gaelic, and she went around in her pony and trap, and she collected this folklore, which she took to Trinity College, and she said, "Look, it's really, you know, Greek and Roman mythology is wonderful, but it doesn't come from this soil. It's not from this land, and we have a wonderful lineage right here, and we need to go around. All of us need to go around and collect these tales and bring them back to life, because it will give" the life back to Ireland. We're going to give the life back to our people. So she was really one of the leaders of the Irish literary renaissance. And W.B. Yeats was really fascinated by this, and George Bernard Shaw and John Millington Synge and a lot of other writers at that time. And so they brought the Abbey Theater to life, and they did a lot of nationalist plays, and I think John Millington Synge was known for Playboy of the Western World, which was a really famous one, and Yeats wrote Der Vergilla. There are many, many, many plays. So she really was an important person in terms of getting the Irish Gaelic, not only the language itself, which had almost died out, she brought it back to life, but also the stories. That luckily a lot of monks around the time of St. Patrick had written down. There was sort of a little bit of a political agenda with the writing of the tales, but at least they were preserved. And so you could go back, and the Irish people are lovely. When you go to the thin places, they have these rambling houses, and they'll put a little jig on for you and tell you a song and tell you a little tale. And so the other thing that she did that was very important is that she went to the schools and she said, "Look, English is fine, but England's a different country. We need Irish in the schools." And so when you go to Ireland now, you'll see that almost all the signs are in Irish and English. And so the language has been preserved, and it's actually coming back. It's really lovely.
I love hearing that. Whenever older languages sort of dig themselves out of this grave that was often created by more dominant cultures, that it makes me feel good. So did you have to learn to read and speak and write Gaelic for your academic ventures?
I had to learn some. It's difficult. It's a difficult language. And I do in my books, if you look at words like Kaliach and Skyach and so forth, and you wonder what this is, and in the back I have a glossary with pronunciation guides, which does help, especially if you're in Wales. The Welsh language is really interesting. So
yeah, that I've seen. Yeah, you can't make heads or tails. Coming from an English phonetic system to a Welsh, and I assume with Gaelic as well. It's it can be pretty challenging, eh?
And the Scottish Gaelic too, and they're different, and also Cornish. So they've all been coming back to life again. I think this Irish literary Renaissance really brought something back to the land, and people. Well, I mean, if you're walking on the soil, all of a sudden something like Tir na b'an becomes really interesting. Oh, is there really a land under the wave? You know, did Cuchulainn of Mrehaefna actually walk these shores? It does something to restore the soul. And there's a lovely tale I would love to share with you about the white swan. Have you ever heard it? The Celtic white swan?
It's in your book. Is it not? No?
I think it's in the book I'm working on now, but I'd love to tell you. Because
oh, no, go right ahead. Go right ahead.
I'm working on Kings and Heroes now. But anyway, there's a lovely Celtic tale, and I think it works here, is that if there's a particular point in your life, and this is quite often the time that we feel that we need to go on a pilgrimage or we need to take a quest, and it's at this time where we're starting to feel like something's missing. Like maybe we don't really know what our ancestry is, or maybe there's just an emptiness inside, or just you feel this calling. And so they say this is the time when you can walk to the edge of the river and you look to see if the white swan comes towards you. And if the magical white swan comes towards you, and if you're lucky, it'll be just as the sun is setting. And you climb on the back of the white swan, and he twists and turns, and he flies through the crack of the morning, of the evening, and the daytime. And as he flies through that crack, he becomes a black swan. And you fly through the night, and you gather all the pieces of your soul and your ancestors' souls that have been lost through trauma or grief over periods of time, and you fly all through the night gathering all of your songs and all of the great things that are truly yours, and you come back through just as the sun rises when the crack of the world is there, and you land back into the water, and the swan turns white, and you return whole.
That is quite lovely. you know something? And it's funny because when you said, you know, the story of the swan, the reason I thought it was familiar is I was thinking of an Indian tale where the swan is able to, he's given a mixture of milk and water. Have you ever heard that one?
I'm not familiar with that one, but I love Indian mythology. So
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. It's just that the swan was able to drink the milk and leave the water. The milk and water were mixed together, but because of the wisdom of the swan, he was able to suck all the milk out of the container and left all of the water. So, swans are obviously pretty amazing creatures, at least mythologically, if not in reality.
And there's some tale, I think this is true in India too, where I know a lot of the old sites that are in Ireland and Britain, the old stone circles, are aligned in a way in which Cygnus, the constellation Cygnus, is somehow activated. And so they would tell that tale when there was a certain alignment, because I guess you could go into deep meditation and do a kind of, the Greek sense, is the Asclepian journey, where you would dream yourself back into being.
Ah.
And, you know, this whole journey, I noticed that you had spent a lot of time in India and knew Indian mythology well. But, you know, this really started for me in a way when I was in India. I went to Mumbai, and there was a Durga Puja going on, and I was so excited that there was a culture that was actually celebrating a goddess, and I thought, my goodness, I need to go back and see if this is really happening in the Western world as well.
We only have a couple of minutes left, but in those couple of minutes, I'm wondering, in the book, Heroines of Avalon, you talk about legends and myths. And you often use the term legends and myths as if they are two separate things. To a lot of people, they would be the same thing. But
I know people in the academy, they like to use a word economy. And so I'm thinking that in your mind, there is a difference between a legend and a myth, and a folk tale and a fairy tale. Is there, and if there is, how would you describe one from the other?
These are all fine lines, but if you take, for instance, the old book, the Labor Gabala, which is the old history of the invasion of Ireland, for a long time that was considered the history of Ireland, and then over time it became a legend, and then it sort of became this myth. Who knows how real it is now with some of the DNA research they're doing? They think there might be more truth to it than we realized. And then some of the stories of the Tuatha De Dunan, which are the tall, beautiful people of Ireland, they were the giants. They were considered the giants, and that they became known as the fairy folk, and that all became myth. So there's a crossover in my books. What I do is I give the myth as it is traditionally given in each culture. And then I stand on the thin place, on the place where the story arises, or one of the places in which the stories arise. And I would write them there, or I would download them. So I was feeling what it might be like to be Anya, the solar goddess, or Skyach, the warrior goddess, who would train heroes to find their magic. And so I write the stories in first person, so that they would then be legends. So I think that, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. And okay. Just in time. I want to thank you so much, Ayn, for your time today, and I hope you'll be able to join us next week and we can continue this conversation.
I would love to.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. My name is Fred Stella, and with me today has been Ayn Cates Sullivan, and we've been talking about her book, Heroines of Avalon and Other Tales. Please join us again next week here on Common Threads.